Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a podcast on the Django Web Framework. I'm Will Vincent, joined by Carlton Gibson. Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will Vincent.
And we're very pleased to have David Kramer from Sentry join us. Welcome, David.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for having me.
Hi, thank you for coming on. Real honor.
It's a real honor. So you have quite the history in the Django space. We want to talk about Sentry, a lot of new products coming out. Maybe for those, you know, given our listeners, we have a couple thousand, and some of those I think are well familiar with you. But for those who aren't, what's the quick story of how you got into programming and Django, and then we'll go from there?
Yeah, you know, I'm I guess old these days, old enough. So I've been around for a long time. So I got my start with PHP, like a lot of folks. And I don't know exactly what the trigger was, but at some point I was interested in doing other things, like learning more things or learning, I guess, how to level up, something along those lines. And Rails was hot at the time, and Django seemed kind of interesting. And I had actually briefly looked at Python before that, and I'm just like, what do you do with this? Without the web framework, it did not seem overly useful back in the day. But it was easy to learn, which is one of the big things in my career. But yeah, so I got started in Django like 0.95-ish, somewhere around those timeframes. And just kind of been growing with it ever since.
Do you remember how
these days
found
I do
it?
A little bit of less, but I think honestly I was just looking. I'm like, oh, we should build, like, we should use a new tech, like a better technology versus this random hodgepodge of PHP. And I was exploring Rails, and I'm like, okay, what else? And I have this vivid memory of just seeing like a video demo of you could put the comments template tag in there. And it just like, all of a sudden you had comments. I'm like, oh, that's cool. You know? and that was like a revolutionary idea, I feel like, at the time. These days it's kind of silly, but you know, at the time that like just made the idea of many different things a lot easier. And, you know, then I compared Rails versus Django and I'm like, well, I have no idea how this Ruby thing works. So
yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. And I don't think anything's changed. No, I mean, and then did you have a formal background in computer science or how did you get into just programming in general?
No, I feel like I was like, I don't know, 18 years old when this was all going on. And so I'm self-taught. You know, I'm both a high school and a college dropout, which means I eventually fixed the high school thing, but then college was also uninteresting. And I guess I got lucky along the way where, you know, my passion sort of aligned with something that pays fairly well these days. And I was very much your like typical teenager who's into video games and whatnot. And that kind of aligned well with World of Warcraft, which was coming out at the time. And I was just clever enough at reverse engineering the data structures in the games. And so like the early part of my career started with like reverse engineer video game, create like web database out of it. And then, you know, one thing led to another that led to like, you know, one job and another job. And then eventually made my way out to the Bay Area to work for what I would describe as more real companies.
Got it. Got it. Well, that makes three of us who are self-taught. So you're in good company. Though Carlton went all the way to a PhD and I'm somewhere in between.
Yeah, so. But not in computer science. Clearly you don't need that computer science background. I mean, what's your sort of thought? I still, 20 years in, get this sort of, oh, I didn't get CS sort of insecurity.
I think it's valuable personally. I don't know. I felt a certain way for a certain period of time in life where I'm like, yeah, it doesn't really matter at all. And then I spent a couple years at Dropbox and they're all like 4.0 MIT grads. It's like a lot of super smart people. Doesn't necessarily mean like everybody's more effective, but when there's actual like what you might call engineering work to be done, they've got a lot more knowledge to solve the problems. And what I mean by that is I was trying to solve some like graph traversal problem and I'm like, I have no idea how to do this.
And they just pull out this.
And all of a sudden, like I've got 20 people who just know like an optimized path through it. And it was like night and day in terms of performance. And so I valued it in those things. And I don't think it matters all the time. Like if you're just building like a login form, who cares? But when it does matter, it helps a lot. And I think, you know, I have a personal take on this, but I do think there's a gap in the industry now because there's been so much like everybody wants to get into tech, but then nobody can do like the actual engineering work, only like the simple web stuff, which, you know, suffice to say, creates a lot of challenges when, you know, there's a lot of like infrastructure kinds of problems or systems or distributed systems. And just nobody has the experience or even academics like to kind of know what to do. And so we'll see. But so I think it still has its place. But I also think if you're determined, it's not super relevant.
I mean, I've found just from my own experience, so I've got every algorithm book and I sort of go a dip in them and but I'm not an expert in that at all, but it is helpful to go, oh, actually, I remember seeing that there's this answer, and then you can go and look it up, which kind of,
I think you can get a lot of that through experience too, but you'll still I would always joke, I have no idea what to call anything. I'll be able to come up with a solution to a problem, but there's certainly a formal name around it or something, and I would never know what it is. Kind of embarrassingly, I spent less than 6 months in college, and in that time is when I actually finally learned what binary actually was and what hex actually was. Before that, I just guessed, or I don't even know what it was, but I couldn't quite grasp what was going on. And I'm like, oh, this was useful. And I learned how CPUs work. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of useful knowledge to understand, because all of a sudden, okay, I took that and now I understand what a pipeline is, from a terminology point of view. And so I think it's just getting people with this, the same vocabulary actually massively helps. But, I don't think a lot of CS programs are that useful.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
Well, that's a little bit like Ramanujan, right? The Indian mathematician who did create everything on his own and kind of did a couple hundred years. And then at some point got up to the 20th century.
Yeah.
That's how you should pitch it. Anyways. Yeah. I'm just thinking back to my startup experience when I was in San Francisco 10 years ago and everyone was MIT, Stanford. And it was exactly that. They may not know how to build a static site, but they all off-the-shelf algorithm stuff. And I certainly think there's nothing wrong with it. I think you get this sense of programming outside of a particular language when you're self-taught. A lot of times you go a couple years in one language and then it's harder to make that shift. But most CS programs, you're touching a bunch of languages. So you abstract away a little bit, which is frustrating if you want to actually do something. But from a pure learning standpoint, I do think it probably makes it easier to just pick up a language. Though, I mean, to your point on video games, I mean, I have little kids and these days, Minecraft, and kids are like, I want to learn Java. I'm like, Java? And it's like, oh, Minecraft. And it's like, oh, man. I wish there was a Python Minecraft, because kids are like, why would I learn Python? I want to build Minecraft.
Yeah. I think that's interesting.
How do I explain this to a 10-year-old,
Just the amount of exposure that people are getting. There will be more Minecrafts for sure in the future. But I don't know how Roblox works, but I know that's kind of in a similar vein of there's a lot of this creator or maker or whatever you call this these days. But with the technical approach, which I think is super interesting for the next generation, because otherwise, you've got to learn this somewhere, right? And yeah, you'll learn theory and stuff in college programs, but the practical application of things doesn't really exist. And we always bias around co-op universities like Waterloo and whatnot, just because those programs where it's constant internships combined with sort of that CS theory, that's the best of both worlds. And I just think that you need the practical application, in middle school and high school kind of age range, grade 6 through 12, and you get that and then you combine it with some theory, you're great. You can solve a lot of problems at that point. And to me, that's the gap. You need that diversity of skill versus, there was this trend of boot camps and it's they don't actually teach you that much. It's cool, you can build an HTML form, but that doesn't get you actually that far into solving problems. And so you can be determined and go from there. But I think the gap is you still have to be determined and have to spend a lot of time self-learning to really kind of get over that barrier. And I agree on the multiple languages things. One of my biggest struggles is whenever I try to pick up something similar to Rust, where it's here's all the academia thrown at you all at once. And I'm like, this is hell. Just bring back something simple,
Carlton, how many books do you have, Carlton, on Rust? This is your bedtime reading.
Yeah, no, I'm just working through a new one on CLIs, which is very good. The thing with learning a new language is unless you're using it on a particular project, it's kind of slow. It's like a kind of back burner, okay, a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit there. And, I've been twinkering away at it for a year or so. And I'm about the point where I'm like, I'm comfortable here. I can just, but it's taken that long because I'm not thrown into the, you've got to get this program working. And, there's a sort of deadline there.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Absolutely.
This is a technical podcast, so let's just jump right into. So Sentry, error handling, I don't want to have you repeat the same thing you probably have to repeat on most podcasts. Sentry started as a Django set, I believe. Is that correct? What's the quick history rather than making the rest of the podcast about what Sentry is? Because we want to talk about the cool details of it.
Yeah. Quick history, 2008-ish, Django debug toolbar, simple snippet, use the admin hooks. And it was a middleware, and that's all it was. Is it would capture exceptions, throw it into admin, and you'd have a dashboard for errors. And that seemed super useful. And so over time, through like sort of open source and community and all this, like I expanded that further to be sort of abstract of Django, like breaking it out and going from there. And it was always just like, how do I make my job easier and more satisfying? Like, it's not fun when you're sitting here trying to like reproduce a bug and you've just got no details. And so there's just lots of times in life where I just didn't have access to the right information. And I would always build things to try to solve for those problems. And Sentry is one of those many things. And it's also probably the one that's been the most successful at this point, clearly. But yeah, and these days we do a lot more, but mostly focused on those developer kind of, how do I debug production code problems?
And then a sense of size, like how many employees do you have? Like, what sort of number do you reach for in terms of, you know, showing up into the right growth? Because I just think of Sentry as everywhere.
Yeah.
But like, how do you all internally think about the growth?
So these days we're like 400 people. Part of that's we just acquired Code Cub, so there's a kind of a spike in growth. Yeah, I think when I thought about building Sentry, I mean, I just like building software. So it's like cool, successful, that's awesome. But like for me, it was like, I just like doing this thing. So if I have to build a business around this thing, I'm going to do it the way I want. And so the key thing out of that was I wanted all of my peers to use the thing I built because it makes it much more satisfying. And you can get feedback. And like the hallway tracks at conferences are always fun to talk shop, you know, right? I want to be able to talk shop all the time in life and not feel guilty. That's basically what I optimize for. And so that's in our company values, we actually have this written in that it's like, we are not an enterprise company. We're very market share focused, which means you treat a lot of things differently. And so for us, I don't know what the customer count these days is, but I do know we have somewhere around 50,000 people who pay for our SaaS service. And by people, I mean organizations like companies, which to me is like awesome. And we achieve that by charging like a fair price and all these other decisions along the way. But it's awesome because like, that is like bigger than most companies in the world that try to sell like enterprise software. And I don't know. So when I think about growth and I think about goals, it's just like, there's still a lot more to do. And that's why we do a lot more than Django these days. It's like, how do we like kind of service and help more developers and more like different kinds of software. And so I think a lot of things to solve within that yet, but that's the main way we focus on where we're going. So it's not your typical like business, what are our goals or what's our growth, you know, kind of thing. It's just like, build it as it makes sense, and optimize for becoming the most successful thing we can be, but from a mind share, not just a dollars and cents point of view.
That's so good. Because I've used Sentry for years and years and years, and I've always had this exact same thing, is that it's open source, right? So I could download it, I could put it on my server, I could run it myself. And I've never once done that because the pricing is just so fair, and you know a lot of things you feel gouged by. I've never felt gouged by Sentry. So I've always just been like, no, I'll just pay for it, because, and every client I've ever had, I'm like, just pay it, it's $30 a month. Like, you know, you're going to save that in the first week from the speed of triage or speed of, you know, you're just going to get more information out of it, and it's not worth the effort to run it yourself. So perhaps can you talk to that, because I just think you've, out of all the companies I can think of, you've pitched it just perfectly in that balance of, yeah, you could run it yourself, but why on earth would you?
Yeah. And I think honestly, like one of the things I've recognized over the years is I build a new hobby project or some kind of internal service, which is basically all I can do these days. And I install Sentry right away because I feel like I'm handicapped without it now. Like I just don't even pay attention to like QA. I just assume that if something's broken that I've missed, it will like show up. And so And the actual realization of that is like Sentry actually provides this immense value from like day one of going to production, where it actually over time it saves you a lot of money because you don't need to bring in like a bunch of expensive vendors. You can actually get away without like logging for a long period of time, like a very, very long period of time. And logging is very expensive, or like the traditional APM stuff, you would have to buy like a new relic or something. And they're also very, very expensive. And you don't use 99% of whatever that product's trying to give you, even if that 1% is actually useful to you, right? And that to me was like the great realization over time. And so we've tried to keep that in kind of in check as we grow and try to expand. And especially as we expand the business side, it's like, remember, like the goal is like that we will expand the market, that we will have many, many customers. And so it's okay to not try to over rotate on the cost per customer. And so when I remember I went through this exercise, and you know, this is not technical, so sorry, but with our VC early on, and it's like, how do you build $100 million in revenue? And I'm like, I don't know, we get lots of customers, and then we just like did the math, and it's like, okay, we need every customer to pay us like $2,500 a year. And if you know anything about a lot of these successful companies, that's ACV. Their ACV is 10,000 plus. It's not 2,500. And so we're actually approaching the business from a very different model. And it's like, how do we just continually drive more and more value? Not how do we charge more and more money from the exact same thing over the years? Like, and like, I don't know, enterprise or whatever. Cause you find a lot of companies, they just grow and all they do is like, they give up on what got them started. Like they start, stop offering a free plan or stop offering a cheap plan. And all of a sudden everything's super expensive. And I don't know. I just never wanted to be in that business. It's not as satisfying. So.
Well, it seems sustainable. I mean, this is one of the questions, like Carlton and I are both in our 40s. Like, you know, at a certain point, it's like, why, how do you keep doing the same thing for a long time? And it sounds like, you know, you're leading with values, which makes sense, right? Whereas it doesn't necessarily matter. You hit a certain growth target, though. I mean, for investors, it's like you're serving a mission. So that makes sense that that can be, yeah, longevity. I mean, but that's exactly the sense I have as well.
You're still vested in the business and you want to hang around. You're not like, oh, sell it off and, you know.
Tell us how you feel.
I mean, I'll be honest. It's draining after a decade plus of doing this.
Sure.
But I'm invested in the outcomes and like I'm still very passionate about it. I think the hard thing for folks to understand is this concept of control. Like you lose a lot of ability to get, the way I describe this is like, if you're a builder, like you just like building software, which is who I am, at some point, very quickly, the company gets to the point where all you can do is describe what you want your like sort of painting to look like. You're like, I want a, like a horse or something. And maybe you try to give details, but you can't paint it. Somebody else has to. And you have to tolerate that like the horse is going to look wildly different than you want it to look. And that's actually like a very challenging gap for me because I still want to be in the weeds and build things. And these days I'm just not, hardly at all. But I still do drive a lot of technology and architecture and sort of product strategy, which I think is what keeps it interesting. And I think the challenges and the sort of continued momentum, you know, kind of keep me going to some degree. Like as an analogy, like I very much want to see this through to a public company, which is kind of the trajectory we're on. And I'm just like, thanks world. I don't know when this is going to happen now because it's like,
yeah,
you know,
you've got another dip.
You know, the tech scene and everything that's going on. Yeah. I'm like, great. Cause for me, that's like the big milestone. Yeah. And I'm like, I don't know, maybe there's a milestone after that that keeps me going. I'm not sure. But that's for me, the really exciting thing right now is like, okay, like we're going to build a public company done a very specific way that's not been done before. And a lot of that's with like our open source thesis in mind and how we've approached customers and like the large market share and things like that. So those are like the exciting things for me, less so than the technology things these days. Though I think at least more recently, we're starting to do more interesting tech investments, which is, I guess, one of the cool things you get out of becoming a larger organization as well.
So I'm sorry, you said you didn't want to talk about technology, but I'm curious, since you're somewhat removed from Django itself, how do you see the web framework landscape these days? Because I always find it's an interesting take. We're very kind of narrow on this podcast.
I worry that Python is dying for anything that's not data science. And I worry because like at the end of the day, there is a shift towards sort of this service architecture, which is abstracting the front end away from sort of the API web side of things. And Django certainly makes it easy to build like a small project, but I never use Django anymore. I'm always like, okay, I want to build like a rich UI, and building a rich UI in Django is actually like quite difficult because it doesn't have a way built in to make it easy to bundle, say like a React application or something like that. And I don't think anybody solved this for what it's worth yet, but almost every time I build a new project, I'm reaching for a new JavaScript-based approach. And my dream would be, cool, let me write the front end in JavaScript and the back end in like Python or something, but I don't want to have to run multiple services or set up like this complicated dev environment, right? Because like my goal is like, how do I just build the thing and like not build the dev environment? Like I don't want to spend all my time just getting off the ground, which I do. It'll take me like 3 days to bootstrap a new project, which I hate these days. And I could eliminate that by like using something like Django or Rails or something that's like more traditional. But then you just lose all of this sort of innovation that's going on with the UI frameworks and those components. So I think Django is still good. And I especially think the ORM is still one of the best solutions out there. But I do worry that there's not a clear decision these days of what is the best and what is going to survive the next 3 years. Because almost every project I start is like broken a year from now, or it's like really hard to rebuild. Mostly because of dependencies and whatnot, but
is that not because you're using JavaScript? Like it's a sort of vicious circle. No?
It is part of it. I will say the same thing happens in Python. So we have this project that my co-founder and I worked on, must be a decade ago, And every year I'll be reminded of something and I'll try to boot it up again and it doesn't work. And so every year I'll spend like an hour trying to fix it or fix my requirements.txt or fix the fact that now it's on Python 2 and I'm even more screwed in this. But and so it's a similar problem. JavaScript's just more extreme to that problem. And so, yeah, I still know Django very, very well. And I still have strong opinions about what works and what doesn't work in it. But I've not actually written anything in Django in quite a while, actually.
Okay.
Other than bolting on like some patches and stuff here and there.
Okay, no problem.
Well, I remember, I think it was it 2018 or 2019 at DjangoCon US in San Diego, Sentry had a big presence. There was like the Fight Club, like bath bombs and all this stuff. And in the hallways this year, there was a lot of talk around HTMX was probably the main takeaway. As to your point, you know, how do we still do Django but not get caught up in JavaScript things? Do you have a hot take on HTMX? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I'm familiar with I've not used that personally. I'm familiar with the concept and the implementations. I think it's a good idea. I think the challenge is, like, you need reactive interfaces, right? Because we don't want to go back to jQuery land where we're doing all this awful, like, HTML manipulation. And I think at the end of the day, like, I don't want to write... to be honest, I've never been a fan of Django templates, but I definitely don't want to write Django templates. I want to write just my actual reactive interface, and I want basically context to be stuffed into that somehow. And so I can't comment on the implementation, especially on the Django side, but like that is not technically hard to pull off. I think the challenge most days, honestly, with JavaScript is the transpilation. Like I have to go from one dialect to three dialects deep. Like I need to go from like some modern TypeScripty thing to some modern JavaScripty thing down to like some compressed compatible layer. And it's like making that process work is never fun. And even early days Sentry, we had built like a middleware, like a Django, I don't even remember what I called the project, but like a Django extension that would do the compilation for you. And it would call out to like Webpack or whatever else Webpack was at the time. There was probably something else. And it was a nightmare to maintain. It just like, it was so complicated. And that to me is the gap with basically any framework these days. And I think it's a lot of opportunity because no matter what, you're going to be compiling some kind of thing or you're going to be doing some kind of asset manipulation, right? You need like that build pipeline. And it's honestly, it's just like, it's way too customized and it doesn't need to be. Everybody does the same thing. Like we all like, we want to like change the JavaScript from one thing to another. We probably want to minimize like image asset size. We probably need to like write a bunch of like, manifest to help the CDNs or something. They're all like exactly the same. There's no reason to have like 50 different flavors of the same problem. Like nobody cares about the syntax of the manifest. Just use one and call it a day. Like,
I mean, I don't want to argue with you, but I would say outside of JavaScript, I feel like most languages have like a behemoth or two that most of the energy goes into. But maybe that's a lead into, I know with Sentry, a lot of what you're doing with error handling and performance is actually switching to the front end, right? Is that correct, right? Which is still some, you know, when people say, how do you test the front end? It changes every year or two, and there isn't a great answer.
Yeah.
So I guess, what do you make of the front end, you know, in terms of error handling and performance these days?
I think it's still way too immature. And I think the problem is people like to reinvent the wheel. I do not enjoy interactions with a lot of the JavaScript community. And going back to the conversation about CS, a lot of them could benefit from going and taking some CS classes, like because everybody just wants to like completely reinvent everything, come up with new like vocabulary for already known problems. And it actually just creates a lot of churn. Like if you look at like the amount of time wasted on reinvention where we make basically no progress, it's like, what are we doing? And maybe this is a little bit of like the tech bubble, but there's just way too much of that. And there are some good things happening, to be fair. I think like React is a phenomenal technology. Take away all the other NPM ecosystem stuff, but React itself is a great technology. And I think if you think about like the servered component stuff that's coming, I think they've got some stuff to figure out on the APIs. Like that is also good because that solves our reactive UI layer, but with basically one like template language kind of thing is how I would think about it. And to me, that's exciting. But I think all the other stuff is like, why are we just reinventing the wheel over and over and over and not maintaining it? And I think that's the risk these days is you like invest in like a technology, you have to upgrade it all the time. Like if you've been working in like on the software or on the backend side of things or the infrastructure side of things, the rule is don't upgrade, don't ever upgrade. Like even Django, like we were on an old version of Django until like I hired a bunch of people and they're like, no, we need to upgrade. I'm like, why? What's the purpose of upgrading? I don't need LTS support. We can patch it ourselves. There are no security flaws because we don't use any of that stuff or it doesn't exist in our version of Django. Like we can maintain that, right? And that's like a maintainer's philosophy of software systems, right? Like software doesn't go old. Like, yeah, there's some things that are problems, but like it works kind of forever or it should. And now the problem is in like JavaScript, like you basically have to update all the time because the dependency graph is just like 1,000 deep, right? And like one thing's going to break and you can't fix it because the other thing's dependent on it. And it's, there is no solution other than to stop doing that, like to stop the dependency graph. Like it's just not good. And so I don't know. It's like, that's my mini rant, but I think it's like, there are good ideas, there's good execution, and we have to evolve it a little bit. But a lot of the stuff we're doing is actually not evolving the conversation. It's just like, you know, re-implementation.
Yeah, no, I mean, I that rings true. I used to do front end stuff, you know, and I used the way I got into Django was doing APIs, and Django was what I used to do the APIs that went with the front ends I was building. And over time, I slowly moved more and more into Django world and back end world because I just couldn't like take the constant, you know, burn down, start again, burn down, start again, burn down, start again. It's like, no, like this isn't sustainable for me, and I just drifted further and further away. That's why I'm so excited by the recent emergence of things like HTMX and Alpine and these much more lightweight solutions that are like, you know, actually they're a single script that you just bring in and then you've got everything you need there. I mean, that doesn't give you the reactive UIs that you're talking about though. It doesn't give you that.
Yeah. I think what we're going to see that happens is we're going to find a way to simplify the service architecture to where front end, back end just become separate. And that's fine. We've accepted that because the only way most of this tech actually works today is if you actually separate the front and back end as like separate services, right? And even if you look at technologies like Next.js and Remix, which have both server and client, the server's not a real server. Like as an example, good luck using middleware, which is like a known, like I have to go like convince them that they need middleware as like a concept. And they're like, whoa, that doesn't make any sense. I'm like, trust me, it makes sense. Like that's how the entire world works is like we inject middleware and that solves problems. And they just, again, it's like reinventing the wheel. And like a lot of this is like, they don't have real world experience of systems engineering that know that these things are like necessary to deploy to real production scenarios. Or as I used to pick on Django, everybody's just building a block. And like, cool, you can solve the blog case really, really well. Or like, so Next, for example, is phenomenal, like e-commerce, and that's cool. But like, I can't build Sentry in Next.js. I can build Sentry's front end in Next.js. And so that might be okay. But that world is still hard because then all of a sudden, I'm probably running Docker containers or something locally. I've got to spin up two different environments because it's not one ecosystem, two different package managers. And it's just that you go down that rabbit hole, right? But I think that's where the world is going, is some version of that service architecture where it's front end and back end, where you don't need to solve every problem in one, but we've at least simplified it. So something like Django or some abstraction can easily manage Django and whatever UI layer I want to use, just like, you know, whatever CSS layer I want to use for that phase.
It's almost like as the web and things get more complex, you need more specific focus. Like I'm thinking, we talked to Craig Kersens from Crunchy Bridge about Postgres, and we're, you know, saying why doesn't, you know, the new generation of hosting platforms have managed databases? And he was like, I don't think they're going to, just because it's just so much more work. And so the sense of just, yeah, there isn't one all in one. There's like, you know, for a website, managed database, I guess dedicated front end, dedicated back end, sort of makes sense as things get more complicated. I mean, it would be nice to have everything all in one, but it's not going to scale. It's not going to be maintained.
Yeah.
Maybe that we're just moving past that phase of the web.
Yeah, though I would push back on, like, I think if we look at these new generation of hosting platforms, they're just very early in their lifetime. Like, they're not deploying real applications. They're deploying, like as an example, like we use Vercel, but we use it for like our marketing website. It's great for that. We don't use it for anything else because it can't talk to our database. And I'm not going to like talk to a database that's exposed to the world, because why would I? Like, why would I add more security risk in what is like the scariest time for security in all of history, right? Like, and I think this is the gap people are not realizing, is like, you can't, cloud is not some magic. You connect all the like random vendors together. Nobody wants to do that. Like, I want to buy stuff that's run on GCP. I want to buy stuff that's run on AWS because I can trust that vendor, or at the very least that vendor has a lot of liability associated with them.
Yeah.
And so I think there's still a gap there. But like what I see, they're not all the same. Like Fly is different and DigitalOcean, of course, is different. But like a lot of them are just, at the end of the day, they're almost like, somebody's going to get mad at me when I say this, but they're like glorified CDNs. And that's fine. That's a good problem. Like if you're just deploying like a front end, right? But my back end's not going there because I need access to sensitive services. And those are going to be like as firewalled off as I can possibly get them. So I think that's still a gap, but it will change. And, you know, we'll see. Like Planet Scale is like cool. But I'd much prefer Planet Scale just be installed in GCP than some third-party service that's going to hold all my sensitive data. again, which is why I think a lot of these are like, they're toy projects right now. Like they're used for prototypes and startups. And even, I mean, this is Heroku even at the end of the day, for the longest time, is like, you're not building a technology company on top of these platforms. You're maybe building like a media thing or a prototype, but at the end of the day, like every real business that is technology, to be clear, and that's different than say e-commerce or any of these other businesses, is running infrastructure on a cloud provider. And that's where everything is going to live. So I don't know what that evolves to, but I just don't think a lot of this view of like, yeah, we're going to interact with these like crazy databases and these, like if you've ever used Firebase, which is just like the most awful key value store, which is like the easiest thing in the world to expose all your data.
It felt sketchy even like 6 years ago. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's awful. It's not by design. It's bad. And you can't fix bad design. Like, you know, we could talk about like the Twitter thing, right? Like Mastodon, I don't think it's ever going to take off because the design is so technically unachievable to do what it wants, to basically re-implement Twitter at scale, right? To collect that degree of social interaction in a centralized place, which is what it needs to do at the end of the day. Nobody wants to like have to visit 20 of these. And so it's decentralized, but it's actually trying to be centralized. And like the solution to problems is to like change the problem so you can solve it, not to overcomplicate it. So I don't know. We'll see.
It'd be nice if there was a, you know, sitting on top of AWS Django specific solution someone did for hosting.
We'll have to see what the new year brings. I want to ask about the Sentry. So you're talking about people wanting to deploy on infrastructure on a single cloud provider like, you know, AWS, GCP, whatever. Is that the kind of model of people who are actually running their own Sentry because they want to keep the data all in health? Or is it hobbies? So, like, who's running it themselves?
There's a few. So sometimes it's a hobbyist that has convinced themselves this is a better idea. Never is. Okay, but whatever. You're going to do you. Sometimes,
it's a JavaScript developer.
No, it's probably like the weird DevOps persona that's like, no, I can do all this. Why wouldn't I run it myself? And they don't realize that it would just cost them $30 and like it's way cheaper no matter what to just pay for the SaaS service. Like there's no way you get your infrastructure cost below $30 to run it in a production app. So that's like silly, but ignore that case. There's the I am like privacy conscious or security conscious and I've convinced myself I'm better at it than Sentry. Okay, the security thing is BS. The privacy thing, maybe. It depends on where you live. Like, for example, we don't have servers in Germany, and Germany's got like a much more strict approach to GDPR. So that's a little complicated. So we get a little bit of that. So a lot of like big enterprises in Germany might prefer to host it themselves. You also get things like sanctions. Like it doesn't matter what your politics are. Like governments are both right and wrong at all times. It doesn't matter which government you pick. And so some countries, for example, we're a US organization, we just can't do business with them. And so, or we just refuse to operate there. Like as an example, like China, like we're not going to operate in China, but companies in China can run Sentry. Like Yandex runs Sentry, for example, in Russia. And like, I'm sure some of the big tech providers in China are also running their own Sentry. And that's cool. That's fine. Like for me, that still achieves our goal of market share, right? That's like the case that I can get behind. There's also companies, and I don't know if they do or don't use Sentry, but like a Lockheed Martin that have like a lot of government regulation and maybe they need air-gapped machines. We're not going to solve air-gapped servers for them, but Sentry can work air-gapped, right? And so those kinds of cases are like real world, no question, like yes, makes sense, right? But I think a majority of it is like this kind of, it's not, maybe not the majority, but it's like split between those. It's like, yes, this totally makes sense. You should run it yourself. And then it's like, why have you convinced yourself this is a good idea? You're wasting your time. And our solution is just like, don't worry about it. Like people are going to be people. They're going to do their thing. And it's kind of all over the map. And to be fair, that persona, the DevOps persona, it's not just the hobbyist. It exists at the finance organizations too. And usually what happens is like, yeah, we can run Sentry. This is fine. We know how databases and stuff work. And then a year later, they're like, okay, we'll buy your cloud service.
Right, okay.
And so... They eventually come around.
And so the second follow-up there, it's open source, but what kind of contributions you get back from like non-Sentry contributions? Like, does that make sense? Community contributions do you get? I mean, I imagine it's minimal, but I don't know.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I've had to explain this to many investors over the years that open source is not a generic thing. And I think people often get confused. So first off, if I say it's open source, a bunch of people on the internet are going to yell at me, and I'll challenge that they are just wrong. But so Sentry's BSL license, which is proprietary, which basically says AWS and GitLab, you cannot sell Sentry. which is the intent of that license, specifically that intent, right? But it becomes Apache after 3 years. And so it's somewhat of our balance of like, we need to fund the development of Sentry because nobody else contributes to it, and to get to your question. But we also want to give back to the open source community, and we also believe in sort of the knowledge transfer of open source, like to not reinvent the wheel over time. And so for us, it's actually like this tricky balance, because it's actually not relevant that Sentry is open source, if you're honest with yourself. Like the part that's relevant is, can you self-host it for free? That's all people actually care about. They're not actually using the code. Like, we have a company that took our open source version and thought they were going to spin up a competing service. They probably have like 20 customers. You know, they've gotten nowhere. Like, it doesn't make sense. Just build your own if you're going to try to like compete. It's silly to think you can leverage open source when it's like a product. You know, if it's like Elasticsearch or something, that's a little bit more complex. But from the community angle, Sentry kind of has like a bunch of different aspects. We have our instrumentation side, which is liberally open source and people can reuse. Now, they're conforming to the Sentry API, which we're not going to develop an open standard around, but like, we have these SDKs that you could technically build a competitor on. I think GitLab is, for example. Again, high risk, but you can do that. And so those are liberally licensed, which there's a lot of value the ecosystem can get off of that, because instrumentation is a complicated thing, right? It usually is internals, not well-documented APIs, random edge cases. And so that's actually a useful case of knowledge transfer and open source. People will actually contribute to that. And more importantly, we basically employ every contractor who wants employed that helps us with our SDKs. And so we've done that for years. We just try to like fund the development through anybody that actually is genuinely interested. And we'll do that for other libraries too, for what it's worth, like RRWeb, which is what powers our new session replay product. We've just funded for, you know, a couple years, like the main developer on. And that's kind of been one of our approaches, like, how do we better evolve that open source ecosystem? But then we have the other side, which is pure like utility stuff. It's not necessarily connected to the end user product of Sentry, but it will be like, some of it is, some of it isn't. Some of it's like, we have all this technology to symbolicate errors. So basically to take the machine readable errors and make them human readable, which, you know, JavaScript has a version which is like source maps, and it's just like deminifying basically and converting back to TypeScript or something. But then iOS has a completely different version. C++ has a different version. Rust has a different version. Some of it's standardized, but like, we now have, I think, the leading solution in the open source ecosystem to symbolicate code, to the point of where I think like folks like Mozilla actually leverage our open source. And I think some of our competitors also leverage our open source to power that same behavior. And they will contribute back sometimes. That's actually awesome, because those cases are, that's computer science. Like, that's actually a hard engineering problem, right? And so we'll have stuff like that. And then we'll have like pure utilities. Like I wrote like a test harness for requests a long time ago called responses, which literally somebody at our company just maintains now. And like, maybe there's open source, but it's widely adopted in the open source ecosystem, and we barely use it at Sentry. And so as an example of like the different flavors we have going on of open source at our company, but the main thing is like, everything we do basically has like a don't ask for permission open source model behind. Like, it's like, if it's a server, you follow this licensing schema. If it's not, do one of these other approved things. We don't care. Just like, build a thing. We're not focused on this idea that like, technology is super secret and we're protecting some IP shenanigans. So the model is very much open source, even if the literal implementations of each one are not like, you know, proper noun open source.
Yeah, okay. But I mean, I remember when Redis introduced a similar license, because they were fed up of getting, you know, their business taken out from under them. And I have a lot of sympathy for them, but the internet went mad and was like, from my perspective, it's still open source, right? Because what I want to know is, okay, look, you know, can I say it? Can I see it? Can I verify that it's, you know, safe to run on my servers, because it doesn't contain malware? That's important to know. Could I fork it if I had to? I mean, not me personally, but, you know, could it be forked if it had to be? That kind of thing's important. The fact that there's a clause in the license that says Amazon can't run our business.
I agree. And I think, like, I'm joking. We might do this for what it's worth. I'm going to push the legal team. I want to rellicense and just name it something obnoxious. my joke was like, it's a business source license right now. I'm like, can we just make it the very serious business license? And we will just like hard meme this on the internet, because the whole idea that you should not have some protection is just like, it's silly. It's like immature. Like, right? Like, what I value out of Redis, again, is that I can run it. That like, if there's a problem, I can fix it. I can maintain it if I need to. I can hire people to maintain it. I don't need to commercialize it. Like, the business I'm in is not commercializing somebody else's infrastructure providing like software, right? That's not everybody, right? Like AWS, that is their business. Yes. And so it's understandable. And for us, like when we relicensed, we didn't have to ask permission of anybody because like the entire contributor graph works for our company. And so there's this like abstract idea that like, oh, you should be mad even though you have no claim over the software, which is just, it's irrational is all I can say. You know, I want great software to exist. Open source is great. I love it. Open source. But like, I mostly just want great software to exist and us to not reinvent the wheel most of the time. And so that in a lot of shapes is achieved through open source licenses. And it doesn't matter if it's free, you know, open core, which I would say is probably worse than BSL or something like BSL, which is just a proprietary license with some protections. So
how does that factor into hiring? I would imagine it helps to have this attitude. I mean, versus other, you know, I don't know, another company that's more proprietary. Oracle. Let's pick on Oracle.
Yeah. I mean, nobody wants
to. I mean, not that you're not, that's not a competitor, but you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think it helps. Not everybody cares, to be fair. And I think there's a lot of different things people think about when they're joining companies. Like Sentry is not an interesting thing to work on. Like we're not doing crypto shenanigans. We're not like AI air quotes, you know, we're not any of these like hyped industries. We're like, no, we're just going to solve a problem and solve it really damn well. And we're going to keep doing that. And so you join a company for personal reasons, right? Like when I joined Dropbox, I'm like, I want to write Python and I want to work something that has like serious scale. And it's awesome if my mom has any clue what that is, right? What the product is. Like those were kind of like the tests for me. Like I don't care about file storage or like syncing files or any of those things, right? Some people probably did. But you have your own reasons for joining companies. And so some people, you know, like Sentry because of the open source thing. Like Armin Ronecker joined early on and like we didn't even know what the company was going to be in that stage. And it was like, cool, we're going to do open source stuff. You know, we can just do whatever we want kind of thing. And it's just like something we were passionate about. And like a number of people are similar in at Sentry. But surprisingly, it is not a big source of pull in like Silicon Valley. Like, yeah, some people care. But I actually think if you look like that subset of people that care is actually pretty small relative to the total ecosystem of developers.
Fair enough. We had one of the highlights for me of DjangoCon this past October was David Lord came by for the sprints and talking with him just about things. And he had, you know, trying to make Flask maintainable, just thinking of Armin's web of software. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I guess we're all biased, right, towards open source. But the reality is, I mean, I remember being shocked that when I was out in Silicon Valley, a lot of engineers didn't care what the product was at all. They just wanted a hard challenge. At first, it made no sense to me. But as I get older, I'm kind of like, well, at the end of the day, like, I kind of see it. Like, as long as it's not totally evil, it's like, am I going to, you know, what I'm going to do is interesting. And the rest of it is all kind of hand wavy marketing sales stuff anyway. So,
yeah.
So what?
Yeah. And I actually think, you know, a lot of companies are like well-intentioned, you know, there's the PR, ignore the PR angle. Like Dropbox, I don't think has negative PR, but like it was well-intentioned. I think uninteresting over a period of time, like Sentry's very well-intentioned. I actually even believe like people love to hate on Facebook. I genuinely believe Facebook is well-intentioned from everything I hear from folks that work there, right? And they also get to solve a lot of cool technology problems. And they also actually contribute, like, I'd say Facebook's actually one of the, Facebook and Microsoft are probably two of the most significant contributors to open source in the last, like, few years, if we're honest with ourselves. Like, and you've got to look at some of those things and be like, huh, you know, that's, like, actually an important thing that sometimes we forget. And I think, generally speaking, great people want to be around great people and they want to be challenged and continually solve like hard problems. Right. And, you know, you can only, you know, refactor the same UI so many times and still call it interesting, I guess, at the end of the day. So,
well, can we speak of CodeCov, the acquisition? I mean, Sentry has moved far beyond error handling. What's your quick take on those areas and what's kind of exciting for you personally?
Yeah. So, you know, I mentioned like our goal, or my goal was always like all my peers use Sentry and I get like kind of that like, hallway track thing. And that's become like the business model over time is like, we have a rule, it's like kind of a soft, hard rule internally. But, if we're going to invest $1 goes towards developers. And what I mean by that is it's not going towards management or VPs or product managers or customer support or marketing or any of these other functions that exist at companies. And the reason is like, if you look at things like New Relic, once upon a time, they were great and they serviced X persona, so call it software developers, and they had great like kind of APM stuff, and then they built a bunch of tools for other people in the company. And I'm like, well, that's uninteresting, and that's also why New Relic is basically failing over time as a business, or at the very least, a lot of people are kind of like taking their business away. And so part of the business thesis is like, one, we should just service the same customer because it's the easiest way to build a more sustainable business because you can just sell more products to the same customer. And you see this with companies like Atlassian, where this is literally their business model, right? And so that's the business angle. From the practical angle, it's like, we want to just make it easier to build software. And that should be everybody's job that's building tech for tech companies, basically. And Sentry's core is monitoring at the end of the day. And there's a thesis that maybe we can bring monitoring earlier in the life cycle, because all it is it's just instrumentation for errors and latency and all these other things, right? Which technically you could get in CI, no problem. And so we kind of want to do that. And that's all for developers. You'll find we don't do any kind of analytics or any kind of product usability kind of things. It's only software defects is what we focus on, right? And that's a very specific focus. And it's because we just think we have to do that thing and continue to do it well. And that's just such an easy concept for everybody to figure out. And so then when you bring in CodeCov, there's a lot of reasons that I was excited about them joining the company. One is because it clarifies our position more. We're not just building we're not going to give you, system monitoring or infrastructure monitoring with a bunch of graphs and widgets and stuff that frankly, I just don't think is useful. We're going to focus on I want to ship the software and get back to shipping the software. And I was always bullish personally. I think code coverage is actually such a useful metric, because what I would do, code review is a pain in the ass for everybody. People just sit in code review forever. And so I always optimize just rubber stamp this. I'm accountable for if it works or not. If you want to review the logic, have I tested it well enough? Start there. Is the test coverage actually testing real world use cases, right? And the simple metric of how many lines of this pull request are covered by tests. Is that alone, just that simple indicator tells you so much, and it's such an easy binary yes, no on it, should this actually be greenlit. And so I think that alone is useful, but also just building more on the CI side has always been a desire for me. It's what I, when I was at Dropbox, I focused on CI and CD kind of problems. And I just think it's such an area that nobody really builds. Everybody just builds infrastructure, GitHub Actions. The sort of reporting angle of it, the analytics angle of CI is just completely awful. The infrastructure to run the tests and everything, it works fine, right? Everybody just solves the infrastructure, and everybody that tries to solve the reporting realizes it's a very hard problem. It's a very hard distributed systems problem, basically. And so I personally am excited to see what we can do pre-production, basically, and basically bridging production and pre-production, where our kind of point of view is always we just want to be able to enable fast decision making. Stuff's going to go wrong. Can we minimize the consequence of things going wrong? And as an example, I'm hoping in January we're going to ship a feature in Sentry that will overlay CodeCov and basically tell you this error, for example, was it tested at all? Is the issue you just didn't write tests? Because people don't like blame, but blame is such a useful accountability structure at the end of the day. I want to know. I should be embarrassed if I just caused a serious bug, and it's all because I didn't write the test, right? If nothing else, that gives me validation for I should spend the time on tests. And if that means I need to, some orgs, it's hard to push for how much time things take. So that helps that side too. So I would say open-ended. We don't know where we're going with the CodeCov acquisition, but I'm bullish on investing in spaces that I think just help us build better software. And so if I could have end to end, I'd be like, cool, we're gonna take you all the way from pre-production to production, and we're also gonna ship the code for you. But I don't know that we'll ever do that, so we'll see.
Okay. Can I ask a question there then, David, that ties in? You said you'd focus on software defects and but one of the cool things you've brought in kind of recently is the performance monitoring or the profiling. And how do you see that fitting into the Sentry? Because it's great and it's lovely, but it's not the same as the exception reporting that started off.
Yeah. So this has been the interesting test. We kind of pivoted our product roadmap recently because we've been building a lot of these, what I would describe as dashboards. And now internally, I'm notorious for saying we don't need any more fucking dashboards, because not even just a Sentry. In life, we have too many things to look at. We do not have the time to look at them, right? And what made Sentry great, literally the one thing that made Sentry great, you could take away everything else, was when there was a new error, it emailed you. It was in your inbox. And it was like that. And so you could kind of trust that if you broke something, you're going to know about it right away. It was proactive in that regard. Now, it might send you a lot of those emails, and there's it's not a perfect model, but that idea is very important. And so as we did APM or performance monitoring, which for context, if folks don't know, performance means two things for us. It's latency. Is it fast or slow? And is the throughput high or low? Because as an example, if signups go to zero, that might be a software defect that's not an error. And it's not a latency issue, right? It's just, I don't know, maybe you deleted the signup page, right? And so when we think about it from that angle, we're like, okay, what are the problems we can identify? And that's been the change in our roadmap of like, of we have the issues product, which is basically just error monitoring. And we released like our first kind of POC in this, which was like, oh, we can detect N plus one queries. That's literally just a software defect. Now, it matters because when if you've never experienced these things, when you have a like a query in a loop, and this is like a common thing you would do in Django templates, for example, most days it's fine. But then all of a sudden you get a high load day and the database is overloaded and that query in a loop is actually like hammering the database and then everything falls down. And so it's almost, I've been talking to people about how to think about what these performance issues are. And I'm almost, it's like static linting, but in production in a way, right? It's not necessarily a problem. It's almost like this is a bad thing to do. It might be okay for you. It might not be okay for you. It's up to you if you should fix it or not, which arguably is the same as errors, right? Like maybe this error is fine. Maybe you don't care, right? You just didn't handle it. And so when we think about APM and profiling and things like that, it's like it has to do one of two things. It has to help you debug a problem better than you could before. So basically depth. So profiling is kind of depth to some degree because it's like function level versus tracing is kind of like network level. And then breadth, which is it should help you identify new problems. And ideally help you identify is not you go look at dashboards and wire up a bunch of custom things. Like we actually try to curate a lot of those rules. And so as an example in profiling right now with that data stream, they're actually looking at like main thread blocking IO, like things where like, if you're doing like hundreds of milliseconds of IO in the main thread, like your app is hung, right? And that's like, oh yeah, makes sense. But that's such an easy thing you could mess up. Again, it's almost like static linting. It may or may not be a problem for you, but we can certainly identify those and call those out. And so, you know, I think a lot of stuff we're doing is in that vein, and I think it's going to be exciting. But I will tell you, we have no idea kind of what we're doing in the sense of like N plus one straightforward. Like that was me saying, hey, this is a real problem. Trust me, lots of Django developers are going to put these in their templates or other things that are equivalent to like Django's template abstraction, right? Or even just API calls. And so I'm like, known quantity thing, ship it, see what happens. A lot of the others are like, okay, now what? What else is like an obvious kind of root cause or like key problem that is black and white? Because as soon as it becomes subjective, it's kind of complicated. Like an N plus one is subjective if it matters or not, but it's not subjective if it's actually like that behavior.
Yeah.
Versus if something's fast or slow, well, should it be fast? Should it be slow? Is there actually something wrong with it being slow that you can fix? What's the something that's wrong? Can we even identify that? And so we'll see where this goes. We don't quite know yet. So you'll see a lot of experimentation from us as we try to figure it out. But I will say, I think it's a much better model of how monitoring should work at the end of the day.
So to take one thing you do, you've got this kind of user pain metric, which is kind of good because it helps you to identify. It doesn't help you debug particularly what's going on, but it does help you identify, oh, that, you know what, that page is causing user pain. Let's go and spend some time looking at that page and we can fix that.
Yeah.
And then you can see did that metric drop after we've released it? Oh, it did. Well, you know, there's progress. So that's kind of
Yeah, and then that's one of the things. It's always like there were always like these keys. Is it fast? Can we tell you about it quickly? Can we help you understand if you should care or not, which is kind of that user pain is one of those many ways you can think about that, right? And then can you reproduce it without having to go like actually take more steps, right? Like if you have to ask a customer for more details, Sentry has failed at like its job in this regard, right? Which is very different than, again, a lot of monitoring. A lot of monitoring is maybe you have the logs, you have a metric on a graph somewhere, and you have no idea what the actual problem is, or you don't have the right details to reproduce it. And all of that, all of Sentry has always been modeled off of like the Django debug page, because I'm like, huh, what if you just put this in production? And that's what Sentry V1 was. Like literally, it was like in Django, it was like, I think I might have even just like straight up taken the CSS or re-implemented, I don't know, but it looked like the debug page and it was just in the admin. And that was like your issue details page. And today Sentry's a little bit different, but it's the same thing. It's just like, let's get as much information as we can for you in production.
So increasingly we have to ask guests, so I know you're not an AI company, but if someone wanted to not reinvent the wheel and, you know, anonymize data, like people are making the same N plus one and other problems all the time. Is there any conceptual way in which there could be something helpful that would just go through your code, right? And just say, you know, here's N plus ones, or here's all these known things that we see time and time again in all these Django sites, all these other sites. Can you see that would potentially work, or is that just not feasible in any way?
I think like, I would argue that's like what we're trying to build. Now, I don't think it's AI necessarily.
Well, right. Yeah, that's kind of what I'm getting at.
Yeah. And so like, I very much believe like we're actually talking about, could we expose So we have this detection layer, and we're like, could we just expose this to the user? And imagine you could build a set of rules that look at Django instrumentation, basically look at the errors that come in, look at the traces that come in, and you could be like, okay, when you see this in Django, it's actually, this is a problem. Like, you could recognize this problem and then create an issue out of that. So we're actually trying to like make it so we can expose that in like almost like a JavaScript kind of language. Because I actually think it's very exciting if you could build these rule sets. And they are going to be like, they're going to be very domain specific, which is one of our challenges, right? Because there's so many different domains. And I think, and then you can take that, again, going back to CI, like Sentry's N plus one works fine in CI. Errors work fine in CI. Latency, okay, you need like real kind of load to show latency. But like those other things, like you could actually run in CI and identify problems before they hit production, right? Now you still need the tests to run. So maybe that's where CodeCov comes in line, like that you're actually testing the code. But there's a very real world where we will bridge that CI gap with production monitoring. And then all of a sudden you have like an interesting conversation about what could Canary be? What could production level QA actually look like if we change the story a little bit?
That helps as well with the problem with coverage, because one problem with coverage is you kind of game it. Oh, you need high arrays coverage, so you write a test that sort of just tests loads of stuff all at once. It's not a very good test per se, but it does execute a lot of code. But that
exactly, it still executes the code.
Right, but those that test would actually be quite handy if you've got static analysis going on in the background.
Yeah, and I actually had to explain to some of the engineers the other day, because I wrote a bunch of we were talking about JavaScript testing being terrible, which it is. I wrote a bunch of tests because it was so hard to actually like test the behavior that just like load the endpoint and check if like a simple element's on the page. Kind of like, I don't think there was Selenium, but close enough, right? And people are like, oh, but this doesn't test anything. I'm like, no. It tests that the code actually runs, like that it executes. And that is like actually such a big deal, because a lot of times you just break stuff because you didn't even run the code. And you'll catch so many bugs by literally just running over the code and not even validating the logic, right? And so, you know, I think there's a long ways to go in sort of like test paradigms, like how we can evolve that conversation. But I do think coverage is just like one of these useful metrics that is like, it actually adds a lot of value. You just, you know, it's flaky historically, which is one of the challenges we got to get past. So,
okay. We've had Jeff Triplett come on a few times and talk about testing. And one thing he always talks about is pretty much every endpoint, you know, set up a 200 test. Did it actually work? So that when you start hacking around, you are, oh, do you know what? We took down the homepage. Okay, well, that's fine.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think we're coming up on time. Are there things we haven't asked you that we should, or things you want to mention to people listening about Sentry and Django in particular?
Yeah, I'm sure our marketing team would probably tell me I'm supposed to plug something, but I don't really do that. I don't know.
We'll do it. We'll say it's not controversial to say you're doing Django, you should use Sentry. Like, everyone's doing it.
That's true.
Price point is reasonable. Like, and there's new features coming out. So
I would actually challenge.
There's nothing controversial about that.
If you are using Django and not using Sentry, I am super confused, and you should send me an email and explain yourself. Because like, I have no idea why that would be the case. And I tell this often to like the go-to-market teams. I'm like, you should know if every single Django production app is not running Sentry, we've done something wrong, especially if they're using like an alternative to Sentry. Because like, we are just so good at the Python thing with like the local debugger, like kind of like the context locals and stuff. But yeah, I don't know. Nothing to shim. Check it out if you're not using it. You know, we're always open to feedback. You know, we're on GitHub, so find us there. But yeah.
Well, let me end with one quick one. If you could wave a wand and change one thing about Django, what would you change? I mean, you've sort of talked about a couple of things, but what would be the one thing?
I would find that path to making it so React can work with Django. Like, that's the only thing that needs to exist, because it's not about like changing a thing. It's about maintaining relevancy. And I actually, the least favorite thing for me these days is going to like a Python conference, because I know what inevitably is going to happen is the majority of people are going to work in data science, which is totally fine. And I have nothing to talk to them about. Right. And so I think we need to like rebuild that relevance of like traditional web frameworks. And the only way you're going to do that is by satisfying some of this JavaScript demand. Outside of that, I think Django's it's always been good that you could plug like what you wanted and take away things you didn't want. Honestly, I'm not even familiar with it. It's probably on version 4 or something these days. And I know it's accelerated the majors a lot more, but I'm not familiar with a lot of the new models. A lot of my complaints are probably from older Django. But I genuinely think it's been a great framework for a very, very long period of time, and has solved sort of the core need since, you know, probably like 1.2 or somewhere around that version. So,
well, thank you very much for taking the time. I know you've a lot of things you could be doing. Appreciate you taking the time to come on here. This is, you know, when we started the podcast a couple years ago, Sentry was like, we need to have ideally you, Sentry, come on because it's part of the core toolkit of Django. So thank you for taking the time.
Really lovely to meet you.
Well, we'll have links to things in the show as ever, djangochat.com, and we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.